Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, welcome back to The Tom Woods Show, episode 2402. I'm delighted to be talking to Matthew Leshak, who is the author of the brand new book, Fiat Food: Why Inflation Destroyed Our Health and How Bitcoin Fixes It. That is quite a thesis. I talked to our mutual friend Saifedean Ammous about this subject briefly, but now you've really honed in on it in a separate book on a topic that I think a lot of people are thinking about more and more as they look around and they see the obesity problem. They look at the ingredients on the packaging of the things they're buying at the store. They wonder what half these things are. You know, I think this may be a case where the moment and the book have met. So anyway, Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And thank you very much for having me. Credit to Saifedean Ammous. It was The Fiat Standard, a book that he published a few years ago that first turned me on to this topic. There was a chapter in it called Fiat Food. And I bought the book to try to understand better his economics. But what ended up happening to me was I got to the chapter on food and I thought it was so outlandish that it couldn't possibly be true. And by nature, I'm an investigative reporter. So for 15 years, my wheelhouse was crime. And my job was, in particular, mass shootings. So I would go around the country for the New York Daily News and try to figure out the motive of why these killers had done the things that they had done, which took me down a lot of rabbit holes. But I had enough respect. So when I got to this chapter, I had enough respect for Saifedean to, even though it sounded completely nutty, Saifedean posited this theory that our food supply had been altered through this 50-year gaslighting campaign of the government trying to make the food supply cheaper to mask the effects of inflation. And it sounded just completely insane, but I had enough respect for Saifedean's economics to look further. And to my shock, when I started digging a little bit deeper, I realized that if anything, Saif had understated this case. And in my book, Fiat Food, I lay out in excruciating detail the argument. And I think it's absolutely remarkable to the extent that industry, religious groups, and most importantly, the government have really conspired, not in a dark room, that smoky sort of conspiracy, but more in terms of out of mutual benefit to completely change our food supply. And you can look around and see the effects of this, as you mentioned. It's people are sick, people are unhealthy.
There are other groups too that are involved in this. It's almost a perfect storm of interest groups and ideological pressure groups that all came together to give us this terrible result. And as you say, when you start to look into this, now, really, my entire knowledge of this is Saifedean's chapter in that book. That's the extent of my knowledge. Of course, now that I've read your book, I've filled in some gaps. But when you look into some of the personalities involved in this story, I mean, John Harvey Kellogg is a very, very strange person. You know, I mean, it is the story, it's almost unbelievable, the story. So let's get into some specifics. In the interest of time, I'm going to bypass the material, even though it's important, but my audience has heard a lot about John Maynard Keynes and his monetary views. So I want to focus on the material they have not, by and large, heard that much about. Now, some people, though, will know about, is it Ansel Keys in the first half of the 20th century into the 1950s?
Correct.
Yeah. So he is positing a theory about where heart problems are coming from. And he's proposing that it has to do, in large part, with the consumption of animal fat. And he is able to make a semi-plausible case for this because he can say, I can show you some countries where they have a lot of heart problems and they have that kind of food consumption. And I can find you the opposite kind of countries. And that goes to show that there's something to my conclusion. But, and so as I was reading that, I actually thought, well, gee, I don't know how you get around that. That sounds pretty open and shut, but it's not open and shut, is it?
No, not at all. Well, I would argue it's open and shut in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Ansel Keynes, as you mentioned, was one of these really interesting characters. He was very persuasive, very charismatic. He looked the part of a Hollywood doctor. And in the early 1950s, Eisenhower, to just kind of set the mood for your audience, Eisenhower had a heart attack. And the country was in a state of near panic. He was out for many days. And the idea of just people walking around and just being struck, falling with a heart problem, was jarring. So there was a race to figure out what was causing these heart attacks. And now Eisenhower smoked 4 packs of cigarettes a day. But Ansel Keys had this theory that the diet that we had been eating for thousands of years in terms of animal fats was the culprit. And his colorful idea was that the saturated fat worked in your body and clogged up your arteries, and then the high cholesterol led to the heart attacks. And he was able to push this theory, which at first was looked at as not as credible, but he was able to push this theory into what has become conventional wisdom. And if you look at the actual data behind these studies, so you mentioned the 7-country study, I'm confident that if you pull that study and just if you looked at it and your audience looked at it, that a 12-year-old could see how flawed it was. Now, these were, not to get too into weeds on science, but these were observational studies, which is the equivalent of handing out a flyer to somebody that asked them what they had been eating. And they're notoriously unreliable. And he also cherry-picked which countries he would use to bolster his argument. So the data was faulty. His conclusions were not, they weren't rigorous science. This was not the gold standard of science, which would be a double-blind study, clinical study. That's how we can really figure out what cause and effect is. Observational studies, you can really easily rig them with data. And we find, once I dove into the actual studies that have built up our current understanding of nutrition science, I was shocked to find that these were all really poorly run observational studies. You have the one from Ansel Keys, but then you have several that came out of Loboland University, which is run by the Seventh Adventist Church, which we haven't gotten into, but they have an entirely different conflict of interest in terms of science. And it's not science, it's something else.
So it's interesting because you do cite some scholars who tried to show that the relationship that Keys was positing between animal fat consumption and heart problems in various countries generally didn't hold, that he was cherry-picking places where the relationship appeared to hold, but that we could cite a billion other places that where the opposite conclusion appeared to be true. So it's interesting that he nevertheless emerges victorious when there were legitimate challenges to what he was saying.
Yeah, and that's not a coincidence. John Yudkin, who was from England, he was a brilliant, brilliant scientist. He posited that sugar had more of a correlation using Keys' own data. He looked at Keys' own data, he's like, well, look at this. Sugar is clearly more relevant here. But after Nixon completely decoupled from the gold standard on August 15th, 1971, and the currency began to degrade, the two most important things people consume are energy and food. And you can go 10 years without buying a sofa, and you can go 20 years without buying a house, but we need energy and food every day. And you notice very clearly the upticks in how these, everybody knows the gas price, and everybody knows how much food costs, because we have to do this as humans every single day. So there was a concerted effort to, and I document this throughout my book, to tilt the table, so to say, to people like Ansel Keys, two studies that affirm the point of view that we should be eating cheaper food, because, I mean, nothing gets people more riled up. And I'll point to Sri Lanka of 2022, where the price of meat went up by over 100% in a short period of time, and the people stormed the palace. The leaders had to flee. And there have been several hundred food protests since 2020. About the high price of food. So they understand, or our leaders understand, that this is a very vulnerable point for them. But instead of reining in the currency, what they've done is they've altered the definition of health. So this is why people like Ansel Keys would be promoted, and people like John Yudkin, who actually had real science behind him, would be devalued.
That seems to be happening in quite a few areas, not just in health. What's the relationship in this story between Procter & Gamble and hydrogenation and American health?
Oh, gosh. This is a particularly interesting part of my book where I learned a lot, was researching and going through old newspaper clips on what cottonseed oil was initially used for. Procter & Gamble had excess cottonseed oil, which was a waste product. Nobody really thought of cottonseed oil as something that people ate. It was waste. It was cottonseed. And they came up with this idea to have it as a new fat. And I kind of look at this part of history as a really remarkable feat in marketing, because this was the first time that for thousands of years, nobody had to tell humans what to eat. They intuitively knew, much like a cow knows or a lion knows. We weren't confused about what we should be eating. But Procter & Gamble began a marketing campaign in the early 1940s to push, or even earlier, to push cottonseed oil as a food into the food supply. And to do this, they brought in a lot of nutritionists who were under their payroll. They infiltrated some government groups to make it seem like it was more legitimate. And as a result, they went from, you could look at polls in a way people perceived seed oils as something that was a foreign substance, not fit for human consumption. By the end of the 50s, it was widely held. And you could go look at advertisements from this period. Are really interesting. They'll show a woman, a housewife, and she'll be like, well, I'm a modern housewife. I don't want my kitchen smelly with lard. That's disgusting. I'm using Crisco, which is what the modern woman uses. And it was a really magnificent campaign, and it ushered in for the first time foreign, honestly, it's not food, it's something different. It's something that should not be consumed by people, these foreign objects into the food supply, and it turned out to only be the beginning.
There's one other person I want to bring into the story, and then I want to talk about the government's role, which largely, but not exclusively, is that its central bank raised prices of things, and then this was a movement to try to suppress food prices by diverting people into eating different types of food. But we have to talk about John Harvey Kellogg. We see this name all the time, and we probably think he's like Walt Disney or something. Not really, turns out.
No, my wife had this idea. I recently sold a screenplay, and she thought I should write a horror movie based on John Harvey Kellogg. Because his life, and I would not have to fictionalize it, because his life was that of what most people would consider a monster.
Well, by the way, this book could be a documentary. No problem at all, right? This would be fascinating for people who don't read books. I mean, it's something at least to think about.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm considering that. I'm sure I was going to talk to Saif about that. But John Harvey Kellogg was a doctor, and he became very close to Ellen Gold. And she was the one who founded the Seventh-day Adventist Church. So just to give your readers, your audience, a little context, the Seventh-day Adventist Church was invented and brought into existence by Ellen Gold, who as a young girl was hit very hard in the head by a rock. And she came up out of a small coma with this ability to have visions from God. And God told her that we're on the precipice of complete apocalyptic destruction as a society. And the reason we are in this state is because we are eating too much meat, which is leading to carnal desires. And the carnal desires, in particular masturbation, is the source of not only all disease, but sin. And the coming apocalypse is about to be brought on by all these people eating meat, which led to carnal desires. And John Harvey Kellogg came along, and they became very close. And he was a doctor. And it's hard to underestimate his influence at the time. He toured the country giving speeches. He wrote books. He had pamphlets, and he had a practice. So he was very influential. He was a celebrity doctor of the time. And he charismatically put on this view. And this guy he'd wear a white suit. He'd have a bird on his shoulder. He'd launch into songs at the time. But his recommendations for young girls who came into his practice and had maybe were hyperactive or signs of depression, or even if they had a sore throat in one instance, he would recommend that and suggest that the cause of it all was that they had been masturbating secretly. So some of the things that he decided to do and prescribe were to pour carbolic acid on their clitorises, or to cage them, or to perform surgeries without anesthesia so that the subjects could remember the pain and associate it with sexual pleasure. So he was a pervert on levels that were that strained credibility. And he would later go on to, which is really in his wheelhouse and consistent with his worldview, he would go on to become a eugenicist, responsible for taking away the ability for, I think, 3,200 women in Michigan to reproduce because they were just not fit socially in his eyes. So he was able to actually get laws passed in Michigan to accomplish that. And I would argue he's been more successful, though, than people realize, because for 50 years, we've been eating cornflakes. And his science was not off. The sex drive of Americans in particular has decreased. We've become less fertile. He's been astoundingly successful. His legacy persists. Every morning when some little boy wakes up and eats sexually repressive foods like cornflakes or corn-based food and skim milk, which has inhibited the male sex drive and the female sex drive and has arguably put our entire societal existence at a bit of a risk in terms of fertility rates and contributed to that. There's other factors.
Now I think I understand what you mean when you say, when you read Saif's version of the story, you thought this can't be right. Like maybe he's got a screw loose or something, but I have to look into it. Hey everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Monetary Metals. This is a company I've been using for a year or two, and it's fantastic. Now, if you're like me, you probably own some gold. But also, if you're like me, wherever you have that gold stored, it's probably just sitting there, not really doing much for you. If anything, it might be racking up storage fees so that over time you wind up with less rather than more. But what if you could put that gold to work for you? I mean, what if you could get it to do something for you? And that's exactly what Monetary Metals is all about. You can grow your gold year after year with Monetary Metals, which offers interest on gold paid in more ounces of physical gold. You can earn 2 to 5% on gold and silver in their leasing program, which supports qualified gold-using businesses. And if you're an accredited investor, you can earn higher returns, think double digits, in their gold bond offerings. All the interest is paid in physical ounces of gold, so your total ounces grow and compound year after year. So over a 10-year period, for example, 2.5% annual, 100 ounces becomes 128. At 3%, 100 ounces becomes 134. At 4%, 100 ounces becomes 148. You get the idea. They've been at this for 7 years. Jeff Deist, formerly of the Mises Institute, recently joined forces with them. Their vice president of relationships, Addison Quayle, has been at my house. He's been a friend of the Tom Woods Show. I've seen him at conferences all over the place. These are our people, and they're doing something really, really creative and important. So start saving and earning in gold. Go to monetary-metals.com/woods to learn more about how to get started with your account. Don't forget the hyphen. That's monetary-metals.com/woods. In terms of the government's involvement in this, as I say, the central thesis of the book is that the fiat money system, and particularly after the removal of any last lingering connection to gold, takes place in the middle of August 1971, you wind up with rising food prices, which leads to, as you've said, there's very little that was going to lead to more unrest than rising food prices, the prices of the very things that keep you alive. And so naturally, there would be a movement toward pushing these other types of so-called food. Is there any other way the government privileges this particular kind of approach to the American diet?
So the way the government has manipulated the food supply is like an octopus with tentacles. So one of the ways is just directly giving subsidies to the corn industry, which has gotten trillions of dollars in subsidies to sugar and to soy. So these three effects of the fiat money printer, which is channeled essentially what is the productive energy of Americans into corn, soy, and sugar, has distorted the marketplace. And as a result of that, we've increasingly put more corn, soy, and sugar into our foods. In the 1960s, there were very few corn products, like high fructose corn syrup wasn't a thing. We had cane sugar. Sugar that was in natural sugar was in our Coca-Cola, which wasn't good, but it was better metabolically for our bodies. Another way that the government has done it is just through brute force. And 1980, we came up with the dietary guidelines for Americans. And this wasn't as bad as it would get eventually. This just basically told Americans to eat less meat and to eat more grains. But this came into fruition heavily in 1992 with the food pyramid, because for the first time, the government told us specifically what not to eat and what to eat. And this was 6 to 11 servings of grains per day. People who grew up in the 90s remember this. And this wasn't just a bunch of bureaucrats throwing out some propaganda that they wanted people to abide by that we could ignore. This now became instituted in every public school in the country. So what we did was we took a recipe for essentially metabolic destruction, 6 to 11 portions of grains, no saturated fats, all cooking oils must now be seed oils. And we put it onto our children, and not to mention prisons, hospitals, nursing homes, but most effectively into school children. So by the time you come out of high school, your metabolism is in just, it's not in a good place. Your health is bad and you're physically addicted to sugar and flour. And it's very hard to recover at that point. So I think that would be the number one way that they've altered our food supply is through the public school system, which then has us addicted and thinking, kind of psyoped into believing that this is all natural and healthy. And you come out of high school and you come out of the public school system and now you're compromised. And not only are you sick physically, but you're sick mentally. You're not as able to discern, your critical thinking skills erode from these waste products that have been put into us for, in lack of nutrition, for decades.
I'd like to make a brief plug, if I may, for one of my listeners. His name's Hal Cranmer. He runs assisted living facilities in Arizona, and it's called A Paradise for Parents. So it's aparadiseforparents.com. And one of the things he does there is to make sure that they eat actual food. He's very deliberately doing
great.
That. They're not going to eat according to the ridiculous food pyramid and have like 11 pieces of toast a day, whatever that heck crazy
was. Criminal. Tom, yeah. It's criminal. And just so your audience knows, and we go through this in the book, and I want to give a hat tip to Nina Teichel, who has done a lot of work. She's the author of The Big Fat Surprise. And she uncovered, and I used some of the evidence that she found in my book, she uncovered that the people who come up with the dietary guidelines, they're all shills of industry. 95% of them are conflicted. So, for instance, we have this moronic woman who is on 60 Minutes, a doctor, in January of 2023. She's on 60 Minutes, and she's explaining that Dr. Fatima Stanford, I want to give her a shout out for this, Dr. Fatima Stanford was explaining to everybody that while we used to think that what we put into our body was the reason that we suffered from illnesses and obesity, is not true. That in reality, why the cause of obesity is genetic. And this wasn't by accident that this came out. And I bring her up because she's now on the 2025 nutritional guidelines. So it's she's paid. Yeah. So she's paid for, she's been a consultant for Ozempic, the parent company of Ozempic. And I mean, I actually can't think of anything more vile than telling people that they're not responsible for their own bodies. Because if you can convince the public that they actually are not even responsible for how they feel, that they then need to basically outsource that information to pharmaceutical companies and medical experts, then you're putty for anything that they want to do. And we see the effects of this. So not only did this was like a very well-organized marketing campaign. 60 Minutes aired this show. Into breaks, it was advertisements for Ozempic. The only other expert they had on the show wasn't somebody to rebut her. It was another consultant for the weight loss drug.
Of course.
The next month, the American Academy of Pediatrics released a statement saying that now they're recommending this drug for children. Now, this is a drug that would replace statins as the most profitable drug for the pharmaceutical companies in American and world history, arguably, because 40% of our country is obese. So you get somebody to have to pay for a shot once a month. It's huge profits. What isn't profitable is telling people to eat meat and eat dairy and go back to the diet that we ate for thousands of years before these diseases came into our landscape.
Here's the insight that it took even me who's very cynical about a lot of institutions, a long time to absorb fully, which is that every person is subject to the same moral foibles we all are. And that includes the tendency toward avarice that we have if not checked. And that includes even the medical establishment. Just because you have a white coat on doesn't mean that the natural human instinct to acquire ever more stuff is somehow sublimated. And once you take that away, now, of course, you're accused of being a, quote, conspiracy theorist if you think there's anything wrong with the American medical establishment. But for heaven's sake, they've been telling us, like, not to eat eggs for years and years. Don't eat eggs, or red meat's going to give you cancer, whatever. And it's all BS. And so it's very hard to look at that and say, well, these were just innocent mistakes. You know, they're trying their best for us, and they've just made innocent mistakes. At some point, did you ever go along with the, like I did, the food pyramid? And you figured, I had no reason to think that nutritionists or the, let's say, government officials who were advising people, I had no reason to think they had anything but my best interests at heart. And what knocked you out of it?
Yeah, Tom, I think it's reasonable. We're good people. I like to think I am. You look like a good person. So we assume that other people are good people. And what knocked me out of it? Gosh, I grew up in the 90s. I was a fat kid. And then I grew up in the 90s. My mom is Italian. She's a wonderful woman. But at the time, and your audience who's a little bit younger might not understand this, in the 90s, you were looked at as a child abuser if you fed your kid meat. I mean, it was a real campaign. There was a kind of like this idea that you needed to, for the sake of your family, really replace all these saturated fats with these destructive seed oils. And I became heavily addicted in my teenage years to sugar and grains. And I mean, I ate so much shit. It was unbelievable. At the age of 16, I got cancer. And I intuitively realized that I had done something wrong. And I remember laying in the hospital bed and asking my doctors how this happened to me. And they said, it's probably genetic. We don't really know. But in the back of my mind, I felt intuitively that the way I was eating was not right. So it began a search for me to find. And it took a long time because I was psyoped. And the interesting thing that I discovered, especially after I read Safe's chapter, was that it wasn't that I needed necessarily to learn a bunch of new things. It was that I needed to unlearn a lot of the axioms I had accepted and built information onto, and kind of go back in time to when there weren't these diseases. What were people eating? How were they doing it? And then once you begin to really see that we are a means to an end for corporate profit and government power, and this doesn't make these people bad. I mean, everybody's trying to make a profit, and they're all just, I don't think it's a traditional conspiracy where there's this group of people who really want our destruction. It's just every step along the way, you're incentivized to push a certain narrative. And behind that, the wind in the sails is the fiat money printer, because there's no opportunity cost. And they're able to put tons of our energy through the inflation of currency and direct it towards somebody like Ansel Keys, towards somebody like John Harvey Kellogg, who then, and the Seventh Adventist Day Church, who currently run the American Dietetic Association. They began it, they're running it now. And the corporations, that's easy. They just profit far more from cheap industrial waste that's addictive than meat, which you eat, then you're full. I mean, it's, so I guess for me, I hope I answered your question. I guess when I was younger, and I've been obsessed with trying to find an answer to this. I've been on a carnivore diet now for about 8 months. I've had a few cheat days, but I can tell you personally, my body feels amazing. Like I feel it. I feel differently, and I feel cognitively sharper. I feel physically robust. And it took only maybe 2.5-3 weeks for me to feel real sizable markers. And I tried other diets. I went all plant for a while when I was in my early 20s, and that didn't work. But a lot of it is just not putting the addictive bad substances into our body. And then we can get all the nutrients we need from me. And I feel like my health has gained immeasurably from that.
Now, I don't know this for sure, because I've never taken a course on nutrition or on a course that a dietitian might take. But my gut tells me that the insights that somebody like you have been having, or that we see from an independent source like a Mark Sisson or a Rob Wolf, that these are coming not from academia, but just from independent thinkers, whistleblowers, if you will, holding up their hand and saying, stop, wait a minute, I think there's something wrong here. So if we were to look to the University of so-and-so to tell us the answer to this, we're going to be waiting a long time. That's my instinct. Do you think I'm right?
Yeah, and it drives me absolutely kind of insane because when people hear that I eat only meat, I always am confronted by people who point out studies. And I try to explain, no, that study you're pointing out to, I have it. I read it. It was conducted by Loma Linda University, which is run by the Seventh Adventist State Church. Every study they put out always says meat is the problem for X. And it's not an actual scientific study. It's an observational study. And the people who run this study are also church members who then integrate data from other church members that don't account for any variables. For instance, Seventh Adventist State Church people don't drink, they don't smoke. And the studies are not science. Okay, so it's PR, it's public relations. And I try to explain because there are some real studies. There's a Minnesota Coronary Survey, which Ansel Keys himself had started in 1967. It lasted 4 years until 1971. And to give your audience a little detail on that, that was an actual study. So that was a double-blind clinical study conducted in mental asylums in Minnesota. And I point out it's mental asylums because all the variables could be controlled. You knew what everybody was eating. And shockingly, we went decades without finding out the results of this study. Eventually, a journalist named Gary Taubes, who has been fantastic in this field, caught up with one of the scientists in it and asked why the results were not published. And the scientist told him, well, it wasn't that the study wasn't right. It was just that the results that we found were so disappointing. What were those results? In 2016, the New York Times found out. They found out, shockingly to them, that people with not only was high cholesterol not associated with increased risk of heart disease, but mortality rate of people with low cholesterol was higher. Of those whose diets in the study were replaced with seed oils as opposed to saturated fats. So you had two groups of people in this study, one who ate meat and saturated fats and one who had a bunch of seed oils. And the people who ate the low-fat diet did significantly worse. We just ignored the study. And it was really one of the very few studies, and it was hidden from us for decades. And I think that if I think about personal autonomy a lot, and I think that's at the root of a lot of our current problems because we've outsourced our perceptions and what we naturally know to be true. We've outsourced that knowledge to experts and credentials. And I just want your audience to just try to evaluate whether we should keep trusting these credentialed experts when you look at the results, because results matter. And for 50 years, they've been telling us to eat a certain way. Americans have complied at a remarkable rate, We've lowered our consumption of red meat. We've raised our consumption of grains. And go to Walmart and look in line. Look at the people who are your neighbors and your fellow men and women. They're sick.
Oh, I have a few more things I want to make sure we definitely cover. So one of them is, of course, in recent years, we've heard from environmentalists who are opposed to the consumption of meat for environmental reasons. They say that it has an outsourced impact on climate and a large carbon footprint, stuff like that. But even back when this new consensus was starting to form, were environmentalists also on board with this adaptation of the American diet?
There was a small minority of doomsday cult type people who pushed this, but once the fiat money printer began to steer resources towards these groups, shocking, we got more of them. And they kind of formed what I consider to be an unholy alliance with the Seventh Adventist State Church. So, I mean, I think the idea that eating meat is a control dial for the Earth's temperature is ludicrous, but it's not new. You could go back to the 1600s when crops wouldn't come up and they'd find some eccentric women and burn them. They were responsible as witches for the crops not coming up. It's an age-old thing to blame humanity for weather. So it's become more sophisticated in some ways, but no less destructive. And I think one of the central points of the people who impose this belief system on us is to make us feel guilt. And once you can really get people to feel guilt about doing the things essential to their own survival, I just think it's a small step to get them to believe that doubling the currency is the multiplier effect, the Keynesian multiplier right. effect, like my favorite one, that actually putting $10 into the economy that we just create from government spending creates $100.
Yeah, right. I know.
It's just yeah, if a you lot believe, of stupidity yeah, going around.
Yeah, no, if you believe that, then cooking with Crisco is no problem.
Yeah, right.
I have to accept that. Hey, everybody, a quick message from our sponsor, Crowd Health. If there's one thing we can all agree on in this deeply divided society of ours, it's that we are profoundly unhappy with our healthcare system and with our so-called insurance plans in particular. They were supposed to get more affordable, remember that? But instead, premiums have been increasing, deductibles have been going up, claims denials have been getting more common. Well, we have another option now, and that's CrowdHealth, which isn't health insurance. It's a better way to pay for healthcare through crowdfunding. You can break free from the antiquated insurance system without breaking the bank and get into a healthcare option that fits your needs. As a matter of fact, look what I have here, a testimonial that I just got via email the other day from Anthony in New Jersey, who writes, I heard about CrowdHealth on your show a while back and signed up with your link. My wife and I are in our early 30s and are expecting our first child in October. To date, they have been great to work with, and I wanted to pass along a good review for them. I was curious to see how this would all work out during pregnancy, but they have been great. Highly recommend it. Well, you pay all this money for traditional health insurance, but do you get that kind of peace of mind? Well, CrowdHealth gives it to you. Your $50 a month membership includes the tools and services you need to get the highest quality care. So we're talking about telemedicine visits, discounted prescriptions, so much more, and no doctor's networks to get in the way. Plus, your own personal healthcare advocate will help you navigate the complexities of health events and even negotiate bills on your behalf. And you will, of course, join the crowd, a group of members just like you who help pay for each other's unexpected health events. Well, it's time you opt out of restrictive health insurance plans and let CrowdHealth help fit your healthcare needs. Get started today for just $50 per month. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/woods to get the healthcare you deserve. CrowdHealth is not insurance. Learn more at joincrowdhealth.com/woods. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. So we should say a word before we talk about Bitcoin, which is obviously necessary given the thesis of your book. Let's say something about the American medical establishment and its role in all this and its complicity in all this. And does it go beyond simply giving bad medical advice to people or bad nutritional advice to people? Is it worse than that?
It's worse than that. Now, I try to separate the doctors from the complex itself because a lot of good doctors on the ground are just dealing with the data that they have and that they're given, and they're licensed by the state. So a lot of good doctors, but the pharmaceutical industry does not profit from our health. And that's one of the difficult things I had to wrap my mind around with the book, because I have a hard time believing people are bad. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies are made up of humans who have grandmothers too, and they have a vested interest in, you'd think, humanity. But how the medical community has been usurped by government agencies who are in part funded by industry and pharmaceutical companies. And I know this sounds like a lot, but I document all these connections in my book. I cite them. It's not a conspiracy theory. It might be tangled up a lot, which it is, but it's there. So when you go to a doctor, you're really getting advice from pharmaceutical interests who have lobbied medical establishments to set guidelines that are then coming through the mouth of the man in the white coat.
Yeah. And this was one of these insights that was hard for me to accept. I mean, I've been very cynical about government agencies for a long time, of course, but I was impatient with people who would extend the same kind of analysis to the health establishment. I'd say, oh, come on, now you're going too far. Now you just sound like a crank. But I think maybe it was, believe it or not, how belated this is, but it was probably 3 years of COVID propaganda that made me think something is, there's a deep rot here. And suddenly my mind was open now, finally, to listen to the arguments and the evidence. And now I feel foolish for it having taken me so long. But yet I still wonder, though, the problem of rising food prices was not confined to the United States. All these countries were off the gold standard. And yet, for some reason, these dietary problems seem considerably worse in the United States than in, say, some European countries. That's at least my impression. Is that impression correct? And if so, why is it so much worse here?
I don't have a lot of firm data comparatively with other countries, but what I'll say is that the government has far more of an interest to keep Americans' food supply cheap. So I don't think they're intentionally pushing unhealthy food. They're intentionally, what the evidence shows is they're intentionally pushing cheaper food, which happens to be unhealthy. And they have a huge interest in, if they're going to maintain power, they need to keep food prices down, or else political parties change hands and real revolution begins. And this has happened countless times throughout history where food prices rise. I mean, as I pointed out earlier, 2022 in Sri Lanka, prices rose significantly and that government was toppled. So they need to keep gaslighting us. And I'm afraid, Tom, it's only going to get worse because the money supply, which has increased, if you weight it, by 14% a year on average, that means they're inflating the currency by 14%. It's only going to get worse. So I think that the gaslighting campaigns are only going to increase. I think we're going to be pushed. I mean, in New York City, you see this. So in New York City, they're doing like meat. They were doing meatless Mondays under Adams, but now to save the weather and to make the weather more hospitable, they're taking the meat away from New York City children on other days of the week. So there will be fed Fruit Loops and Cinnamon Toast Crunch breakfast bars, which are high in whole grains, these high sugar, low fat foods, skim milk, which is really just kind of a waste product. They took away our whole milk. So it seems to be increasing. And that's why I really appreciate you having me on your show, because there is considerable pushback going on right now from skeptics who look around and say enough.
Let's shift gears now and just say a little something about Bitcoin, because your book is published by Saif Edeen's brand new publishing house. And he, of course, has a particular emphasis on Bitcoin. So I would be remiss not to discuss at least a bit about that portion. So you have a section on Bitcoin where you go point by point through various salutary features of Bitcoin and how it's relevant to this particular situation. So that's everything from economics itself to government to human nutrition, and so on. Rather than give away your entire book, how would you summarize why what would appear to some people to be rather an obscure issue, namely Bitcoin, could in fact be central to this question?
It's entirely central to the question, because the distortion that we're living under, this PSYOP, is created and maintained by fiat. By fiat currency, what it does is it, to have a money printer, essentially can harness and weaponize the entire productive labor of an entire country. And in this case, the most productive country on the history of the earth. The fiat machine is able to harness all that energy through the devaluation of currency. And I'm going to be honest with you, I'm not a Bitcoin expert. But what I do understand is that it will destroy the fiat system. So I look at Bitcoin, and I don't think it would only be Bitcoin. Any hard currency that could come in and destroy the distortions and the PSYOP created by and to maintain the fiat money printer would work. Bitcoin, from my knowledge base, and I'm not, I think, Tom, you probably have far more of an understanding of Bitcoin, and I know Saif does, but by just destroying the fiat money printer, that alone will give clarity and allow people to see clearly. And for instance, if we have a hard currency like Bitcoin or even gold, but Bitcoin would be better, and the government wants to send $7 trillion in corn subsidies, they need the consent of the American public. They can't just print the money out and give it and devalue everybody else's money. They need to go to us and say, so this $7 trillion in gold, we're going to give to this industry, the corn, sugar, and soy, or we're giving to these scientific studies that are going to come up with these unscientific results. They would need our consent. And that change, it's impossible to overstate the impact a hard currency would have on the government's ability to continue perpetuating this nonsense. But more importantly, it would remove the incentive to, because meat would stop going up in price. Eggs would stop going up in price. The incentive would be stripped away. We would be allowed to just eat naturally without these corrupting influences channeled from the American public into this real diet of complete waste that's made the American public completely sick.
I'm sitting here just thinking, as we're getting close to wrapping up, about practical steps people can take to improve their health. And in some ways, it's not all that difficult, as you say, in terms of changing their diet. It's a bit of a challenge if you want to eat at restaurants frequently, things like that. But I'm also thinking about, for people who want like a health coach that will advise them on fitness and food intake and so on, I wouldn't go to the average random person I would find using a Google search, because that person is stuck in 1977 and wants me to eat the kind of meals that Michelle Obama wanted poor, hapless school children to eat, which was super low-fat meals that can't sustain you during the day. So I do think about, I've had Mark Sisson on the show from the Primal Blueprint, and some time ago, he actually started certifying health coaches. So he has primal health coaches, so that you can actually talk to somebody on a regular basis who can help you modify your diet, make sure you're eating good things, but also that you're getting, it doesn't even have to be, he used to be like one of these crazy, almost Iron Man kind of guys, like marathon runner and everything like that. He said, you don't need to do those super extreme things with your body, but you do need to do some things. You do need to be sort of active. And so I would recommend checking that out. I don't have any relationship with him, but I used one of these people at one point and I found it very helpful. So the point is, the knowledge is out there. The people who can advise you are out there, but you have to make, in this climate, you have to make a special effort to seek out particular people and not just the standard people who are going to tell you that your obesity was inherited and there's nothing you can do about it. That's no good. But also they should, frankly, I'm not saying this just because you're here, but I would tell people that they should read your book, because it's highly eye-opening. It's extremely persuasive, and it is a very, very good starting point. So once again, it's Fiat Food, Why Inflation Destroyed Our Health and How Bitcoin Fixes It. If you have any parting words, I'd be glad to hear them.
No, thank you so much for having me on, Tom. And I would push back slightly on the idea of needing any kind of coach. Your body knows. You don't need to outsource this to anybody. Your body knows. Our body, my body knows. Eat meat, eat cheese, eat dairy. If your ancestors didn't eat it 100 years ago, good rule of thumb, probably don't put it in your body. 500 years ago would be even better, but you know what to eat. We know what to eat. I mean, how do we get to this place where the cow knows what to eat and we need to buy and spend billions of dollars? Save your money on the life coach. Go buy some ribeye steaks.
Fair enough. Well, that is indeed what is done very often around here in the Woods household. We are very, very much in favor of our various cuts of steak. And I remember I lived through that period too, where eating red meat was demonized and basically only a stupid backwoods hick was still doing it. And didn't you know that? But in those days, I do remember that there was some distinction made between kinds of meat. It was better for you to eat something like chicken than it was for you to eat beef. They would make that kind of distinction. Whereas I think today, they're not making these kinds of careful distinctions any longer.
Exactly. I mean, the best part, the healthiest part of ribeye is the fat. And you can go to New York City right now and look at the little outside diners, these women, and they're carefully cutting the fat out of their meat. It's insanity. That's the lifeblood of humanity.
Yeah. And by the way, let me just confess before the whole world here that I used to do that partly for what I thought were health reasons, but partly because I just didn't like it. But I think I'd been conditioned to not like it because it wasn't supposed to be good for me.
And it's called fat. Who wants to put that in?
I know. So it doesn't sound very good. You think fat makes you fat. So I thought, well, if I have a cucumber, I'll be in much better shape. But
right. But
now I've kind of retrained myself because I would, and particularly because my oldest daughter, if she has a steak, there isn't one bite left on that plate when she's done. And I thought, I'm not going to be outdone by my own kid. And so I've retrained myself. Now I really think, what was wrong with me? This is delicious. I should be doing it. So anyway, I'm really glad that you've done this, that you took what Saif presented sort of in germ in that book and expanded it into a full-blown study. It couldn't have come at a more urgently needed time. So again, Fiat Food is the book. Matthew, congratulations on it, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.